planet is about to make a comeback. The living planet is about to make a comeback.
10% charge.
The living planet is about to make a comeback. And that's really, really good news.
Welcome to Nature Back Blast on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This July 18th, 2017 edition, episode 107 of Nature Back Blast comes to you live from New London, Ontario, as well as from Kansas City, Missouri. That's where I am. We're hearing from Corey Morningstar, your new host on NBL on PRN. We are taking your calls today, and we also have a guest. Please give our guest a little time to articulate his work, and then call us with your toll-free comments and questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Corey, are you with me? The piece was 7,300 words long, and It drew extensively from my work. It drew from my written work, and in addition, David Wallace Wells, the author of the piece, interviewed me for an hour or so. He also interviewed my partner in Belize and quoted us heavily without attribution. That was an interesting experience. A mainstream, well-recognized journalist. In any event, it was pretty obvious that he was quoting me because what followed immediately after the piece came out was a veritable shitstorm of response from people who are perfectly capable and willing to deny the evidence about abrupt climate change. In particular, The Guardian, Grist, The Washington Post, and others pushed back pretty hard. Now, that's pretty interesting because the piece didn't go far enough, although it quoted heavily from my work. In the end, as the author pointed out, he just couldn't believe the evidence. And so it was a stretch too far for him to talk about near-term human extinction in the near term. So instead, he wrote about a century away. So he talked about the horrors of abrupt climate change, articulating what is going on today, and then failed to recognize that we are in the midst of a process which has precedence in planetary history and will, with great certainty, lead to loss of habitat for humans in the very near future. Instead, he took the IPCC conservative route, and pushed it off for another century. I think this is a horrible, horrible outcome from what could have been a significant piece of mainstream literature. Unfortunately, David Wallace Wells was just a little too afraid to go that far to accept the evidence, so we're left with instead a relatively weak form of denial of evidence, and a tremendous pushback. Michael Mann, perhaps the best-known climate scientist working in the world today, distinguished professor at Pennsylvania State University, wrote, along with two other colleagues, an op-ed piece in the Washington Post. And in that piece in the Post, Professor Michael Mann, referred to me as, quote, a doomist cult hero. That's right, a doomist cult hero. And he also libeled me, which I've become accustomed to, of course. He indicated that I said there would be no life on Earth within a decade. I have never written that. I've never spoken that until just now. And I'm quoting Michael Mann, misquoting me. So I'm not too concerned about the doomist cult hero, although I think it stops a little short. I think it would be more appropriate, more accurate to call me a doomist cult superhero than merely a doomist cult hero, but whatever. But the libelous part where Mann and colleagues refers to me as somebody who says there will be no life on Earth within a decade is just absolutely libelously wrong. So that's insane, ridiculous, and I'm not at all surprised. However, I'd like to point out that the problem with the scorched earth policies we've been pursuing for the last few hundred years, arguably since civilizations arose, is that it in fact leaves us with a scorched earth. And if anybody's been paying attention to the stories, the newspaper stories about the fires in Canada, for example, you know that we are leaving a scorched earth in our wake. To deny that, to push that away, to claim that we, in fact, can turn this thing around using the tools rooted in the omnicidal heat engine known as civilization is absurd. And absurdity is what I've come to expect from the likes of Michael Mann and people writing for Grist and The Guardian. Grist is an excellent example. Actually, at the Grist article, they agreed with the Washington Post and several others in writing that David Wallace Wells had just gone too far, that that can't possibly happen within 100 years. And interestingly, the new guy writing for Grist, who replaced David Roberts,
hey, guys, are you there?
Yes, I can hear you, Corey. Can I just finish this?
Hey, sorry to interrupt. I'm actually sitting on the floor of the studio at CHRW at Western University at the radio station. The guys are really trying their best here to get me set up. We just have technical issues, but I've been listening to you for the past few minutes, and I wanted to jump in. I'm just on the phone right now calling in.
Thanks. Technical issues with this show? That's inconceivable.
Imagine. Imagine. So tell me more about what's been happening with this guy. You've got some sort of copycat stealing your work and running with it. And Michael Mann, imagine, not happy with you and bad-mouthing you. Tell me more.
Yeah. It goes on and on. I've told most of the story. Perhaps you missed most of it.
I was just saying.
David Roberts used to write for Grist and left within the last year or so. I don't really remember the date.
Yeah, I didn't realize he had left.
Yeah, the guy who replaced him wrote a denier piece saying that this David Wallace Wells piece just goes too far. Interestingly, yeah. David Roberts himself came out with a piece at Vox.com the next day, pointing out that the piece doesn't go far enough. So I think David Roberts is one of the people who actually gets it, who's writing for the mainstream. And maybe that's why he's not writing for Grist anymore.
Maybe that's why he left.
No doubt. Very well be.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I absolutely agree. I suspect that is why he left, whether it was of his own volition or they just had a divergence of views between him and Grist. We'll never know.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember who the funders are of Grist and who's on the board of control, but it's the usual, or the what is it, the board members, you know, the usual cast of characters. The foundations and everybody you expect to keep everything going every day, keep the civilization functioning and running, right, and annihilating. Have you had a chance to talk about, like, is Michael with us?
That's what I was just wondering. Is Michael there? Can you hear us? We have a guest.
Like, I wanted to ask you, is Michael here? Michael?
Yes.
Did we lose Michael, too?
I just heard a little beep from Michael. So, Corey, would you mind introducing our guest today?
Yeah, and maybe if we have time, Guy, I wanted to ask you, and I'm sure the audience would like you to expand on it, about the Larsen Sea Shelf, the Antarctica Peninsula Larsen Sea Ice Shelf. If we get time, maybe we can come back to that.
That'd be great at the end of the show.
Okay, so Michael is with us, right? Because I want to introduce him.
Michael is definitely with us.
Okay, because I can't hear him on my end. Okay.
I'm here.
Hi, Michael. Okay, Michael, I just wanted to introduce you to our audience. Michael Swift is a volunteer activist and advocate residing in Brisbane, capital of the coal, gas, and beef state known as Queensland, Australia. He is part of the Critical Thinking Collective, Wrong Kind of Green, and a self-described messaging obsessive. His work focuses on the nonprofit industrial complex with a special interest in the development of the Galilee Basin Coal Complex, network hegemony, the collateralization of nature for the quote-unquote new economy, and in highlighting the political will for fossil fuel-driven industrial decarbonization. You can find his writing at his blog, We Suspect Silence, as well as on Wrong Kind of Green, and his Twitter handle is @empathizer. Michael, language today is an essential, if not key, component of psychological warfare and the construction of conflated logics. We see the strategic, we see this strategically utilized within the nonprofit industrial complex. Michael, can you attempt to convey to our listeners today why it is critical to analyze language? And by that, I mean how language plays a vital, if not key, role in manipulating both the message and the meaning. And then if you could talk about that, and basically if you could, if you have any thoughts on how one can teach oneself to deconstruct language in order to understand the intent behind the manufactured movements that we witness dominating civil societies today. Did you get all that, Michael?
Okay. Yes, okay.
So you
hear me?
Start wherever you want.
Okay. So you can hear me? Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine. We can hear you just fine.
Yeah, you sound good.
Okay, great. Okay.
Were you able to hear my question?
Language largely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, language largely creates or shapes reality. And I think Jay Tarver points out very clearly that this is what Guy Debord was talking about. Both the silences, the things not referred to and not unpacked, and the things that are said, frame for people in their busy lives with the sort of lack of time to access media in any deep kind of way, frames the reality for them. Yes.
Just a minute. I think we have a caller. Can I introduce a caller right here?
Yes, please.
Angie Berkeley.
Hello.
Hi, Benji.
Yeah.
Hi.
Benji, yeah.
Thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Is this the Guy radio show?
Yes, it
Hello?
Is.
Okay. Well, you know, there's a period of time which is rife with all sorts of sorrow and strife. When you wish you'd have died, yet you don't suicide. It's that period of time we call life.
Okay.
Thank you, Benjamin the Donkey. Calling today as Benji from Berkeley. We always appreciate your limericks on the air. So
I think
thanks
we're,
for that.
I think we're, yeah, thank you very much. I think Michael's going to call in. I think he's fading on us, Guy. We're having a few problems today, so bear with us, Nature Bat's last audience, and apologies. Michael, are you calling in? Are you with us yet? Anyway, while we're waiting, Guy, why don't you just talk about the Larsen seashelf if we have a minute?
Yeah, we do have a minute, and
okay.
I'm sure the studio will let us know via the IM when Michael has a secure connection. So,
okay.
One of the things that happened last week was, according to the climate scientists, not supposed to happen for another few centuries or millennia. And that was breaking free of the Larsen Sea ice shelf in Antarctica. So this iceberg is now floating out in the ocean. It's the size of Delaware, the state of Delaware. That's an enormous bunch of ice that just broke up. It was floating. So it will not contribute to sea level rise. It was floating ice already, so like an ice cube in your glass of water. When it melts, it doesn't raise the water level in the glass. But Larsen C was important because it acted as a dam for many, many, many millions of tons of land-based ice or terrestrial ice behind it. So the breaking off of the Larsen C ice shelf has opened the dam, has broken the dam, and will allow all that ice that's on land to now flow into the Southern Ocean off of Antarctica. So this is a big deal. It was such a big deal as in terms of media response that I saw it in one or two pieces of mainstream media for about 15 or 20 seconds, and then it just vanished.
I was going to say I noticed that they really minimized it, and anywhere, you know, that I saw it mentioned, I'd briefly scan through it, and they always really minimize, you know, the event and what had happened. So it is a big deal.
It's really huge.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, like every other huge indicator of abrupt climate change, is essentially being ignored. And this is an indicator. It's telling us that something is going on here that is unexpected, that is, quote, faster than expected, like we haven't heard that one before. And the mainstream media are just turning away from it. I'm not particularly surprised. It's not that this event is going to directly cause the deaths of a whole bunch of people. Nothing like that. So as a consequence, it doesn't make the mainstream media. You know, this is the equivalent ultimately of sending ships into battle. Now, when the ships are sent away from the port, a lot of people don't realize what that means if they're going to war. They just left the port. They haven't gotten there. They haven't killed anybody yet. So what could possibly go wrong? Well, as it turns out, a lot of things could possibly go wrong. And rather than taking the precautionary approach, using the precautionary principle, it seems that most of the people in this culture just write it off and believe what the mainstream media tells us, that it's nothing to worry about, that those ships are just going on a training mission. And that's the Larsen C. The Larsen C is a real emergency, folks. It's indicative of an ongoing emergency. It is.
Where did you read about it, Guy?
I don't recall. It did make the mainstream media in a few places last week, the day after it broke off. And so it was out there. You know, it popped up in people's Facebook feeds and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But then it just mysteriously disappeared very shortly thereafter.
Yeah, I found it on the Weather Network, of all places. Yeah, that's where it was.
That's great.
Do we have Michael back? Michael,
Hello? Maybe
not yet.
Hello? Hello?
Michael.
Hello, Michael.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. Good.
Yeah, Michael, if you could pick up where we left off, explaining to the audience about the psychological warfare construction of the conflated logic, conflated logics, what that is and what that means.
Okay. Well, maybe I can use an example that I focus on, and that is clean energy.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, only a couple of days ago, the Senator for North Dakota, Senator Heidi Heitkamp, announced a bipartisan bill for carbon capture, utilization, and storage. And she announced her very good friends of coal and celebrated the bipartisanship behind that, which includes the support of the largest industrial union in the U.S. What she's doing is a product of a long process that's been overseen by a group, Clean Energy in its name, Clean Energy International Group, but it powers a process of carbon sequestration. Only a couple of weeks ago, the Clean Energy Ministerial hosted a meeting as clean energy included carbon capture and storage. So what we have is interest under the banner of the energy. And
Michael, can I interrupt you just right there for a second? Michael, if you can call in at the 888 number instead of using Skype, perhaps that will give us a better connection. So I will chat with Corey for a few minutes, and if you can check the number that just showed up on your Skype IM and call us there, that might give us a better connection. Thanks very much.
I hope Michael gets back to this guy. Like, he's honestly one of the best minds on the nonprofit industrial complex and how it functions and how it works and why that I've actually ever come across. So I'm really, really, we're actually really fortunate to have him on the show, and hopefully he'll be back with us and we'll, you know, get a handle on some of these technical issues today.
Yeah, we're doubly fortunate because he's calling from Australia where it's not even 5:30 in the morning.
Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah.
So it's 5:30 in the morning tomorrow. So as is often the case, Michael is ahead of his time. But in this case, it's not helping us much, those who lag behind here in North America.
Do you know if we're having our Serena Raphael, our Western Australia correspondent, will she be with us today? Do you know?
Serena will not be calling in today. It's
okay.
Not quite 3:30 in the morning for her.
We demand a lot of others.
That would be enough to stop me from a volunteering gig like this. But she's actually working in an animal health clinic, taking the late shift. So she actually is doing compassionate work instead of talking about compassionate work right here.
I'm not sure if she had a chance or if she talked about it while I was working in the studio with the guys trying to sort out these issues with our, with all the technology here. But were you able to talk about your tour at all? I just wondered how it's going, the tour.
Yes, I was, and that's a good point in that I'm quoting Serena now in all of my presentations. I'm often accused of destroying the future for young people, although we could go down that road for the rest of the show, and we wouldn't complete my thoughts on that topic. But I point out that for students such as Serena Raphael in Western Australia, I'm not destroying their future. I'm actually liberating people. And Serena has said on more than one occasion that my work has completely liberated her. She can do what she loves without guilt, without shame, without feeling a sense of blame. And I want to tell a story that I've been telling to some of my audiences here, although I don't tell it all the time, in part because I get so worked up that I cry every time I tell the story. So I'd appreciate your patience and forbearance here. Serena came home from college one day, and her baby boomer era instructor had been telling her the same thing that the instructors tell millennials every day. Serena came home to her housemate behind a locked bathroom door, and she knocked on the door to try to figure out what was going on. And it took a while. It took some convincing, but finally her housemate opened the door. And then Serena found her housemate covered in tears and blood. She was attempting to commit suicide because her professors had lied to her again today. They lied to her about how bad the situation was, and they told her that my generation messed it up. Us baby boomers made a horrible mess out of the situation, and your generation is going to have to fix it. So it's bad enough to tell millennials that the situation is fixable. What I think is unforgivable is for baby boomers to tell millennials that we screwed it up for a few dollars more, and it's up to you to fix it now. I think that's heinous.
Yeah, and we continue to screw it up. I mean, I've had the pleasure of, getting to know Serena and her work. Recently, I read something. Well, the last show, we read something gorgeous that she had written. And then following that, I read another piece that she had written. I think it was published on Nature Bats Last. And, you know, I've just had the pleasure of being able to converse with her over email and preparing for these shows. And what a breath of fresh air it is, you know, to meet someone of that age who is just so thoughtful in her analysis, you know, and able to articulate, being able to articulate the such heaviness, you know, that those who are aware actually carry on their shoulders and in such a beautiful way. Anyway, I'm just absolutely impressed with Serena, and she's a fantastic role model for youth today and has so much to offer, you know, and I see people like her and, quite a few others like her on, you know, social media and blogs and that type of thing. And God, I mean, this is what we need. This is what we need. We need to be thinking critically and to be looking at reality in the face, you know, not looking away and joining, you know, all these illusions and just accepting, you know, what we want to hear rather than the reality of the situation. So anyway, I don't know how you found her, Guy, but I'm glad you two somehow met. And, yeah, it's a really great example of the work that you're doing.
Well, she found me, actually.
Okay, how did that go down?
Well, she came across me from years ago. She read about my work in her college classes from a long time ago. I believe she read the book Killing the Natives, Has the American Dream Become a Nightmare? That book came out in January 2005. So her knowledge of me goes back a long way before she ever contacted me. And when she first contacted me, it was so that she could potentially host a tour for me in Western Australia. And the situation has evolved since then. I have a tour planned in Australia in November and December that will involve her, perhaps not as a host, but at least she'll be involved.
Yeah.
It is. It's awesome. You know, when I was a kid, I was promised flying cars long before now, and apparently we can't even make a phone call. And
well,
I used to complain when I was on tour that we didn't have the technology here in 2017 to project images on a screen, and we still don't.
Well, how then are we going to get a whole new colony on Mars? I'd like to know, since we can't even get this phone call to work. I think it might be a lie. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it might, in fact, be a lie that we're going to have colonies on Mars, at least colonies of humans on Mars.
We're going to grow produce in space, even though we can't even manage to grow it locally in our own communities. That's interesting as well.
We better get started on that research. Let's abandon the research on growing life here on Earth, because obviously we're not really good at that. We can kill life here on Earth, but we can't produce it. So let's go to space to give it a try there.
Yeah, anyway. I guess we don't have Michael back. Is he going to call in, or do we know?
No, Michael is done. We failed to make the connection.
Anyway, back to our conversation about your influence on millennials. I think it's so empowering. I mean, I've watched, young people sort of come into groups on social media, and they basically, you know, let's face it, in this society, if you're interested in the environment and that, right away, you're sort of put into the thrust of Greenpeace and 350.org of Oz. You're sort of sucked into that community, right? That's where people go. And then eventually you start finding your way, like asking questions and start wondering why, you know, nothing happens over there and they're not telling you this and that. And so anyway, I see, young millennials like Serena coming into these groups. And you can see that it's really, really empowering, you know, for these youth to finally be getting the answers that they're after. you know, and I just think it's so important that we stop, you know, lying to our children. I mean, it's bad enough that we lie to ourselves, you know, let alone lie to students and youth.
Yeah, you know, but it's way easier to lie to ourselves than to face the truth. And just the other day, somebody sent me a short clip from Fury Road, which is the latest Mad Max movie. Came out in 2015. Yes, no, really, I'm going somewhere with this.
Okay.
I don't often bring references in from pop culture, but there's this great line in the film where the protagonist says, "Hope is a mistake. If you can't fix what's broken, it'll drive you crazy." And this is why I'm hope-free, because I can't fix what's broken. Hope is wishful thinking. It's delusion. It's the emotion that has on the other side of the I don't know the future coin, fear. So these two four-letter words are on the opposite sides of the same coin. I can't predict the future with accuracy, so I hope for the best, as if somebody else is going to fix it. Or I fear the worst, as if it's going to turn out badly.
Right.
Why don't we live hope-free and fear-free and live in the now and actually take action to try to make for a better tomorrow, but not hope or wish or carry on as if somebody else is always going to step in and do something, somebody like a vase or...
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And I mean, that's part of their strategy and part of the reason they're so powerful. You know, I think we've all taken this attitude, someone else will fix it, straight across the board, and it's a huge problem. And it ends up, you know, we're all getting corralled by the same hegemonic forces at the top. And it's, yeah, is this something, Guy, that you're going to talk about on your tour? Or just, you know, I'm sort of interested. I've never caught you on tour yet. And is this the type of thing that you talk, like people can expect if they come and talk to you and listen to you?
Yes, absolutely. You know, when I started talking about this information in my out loud voice more than 5 years ago, I was the medical doctor who would walk into the room with a clipboard, never make eye contact with the patient, and spend about 15 seconds to tell the patient they have a terminal diagnosis, and that in 99.9% of the cases, you can expect to die in 6 weeks, and in the others, you might live as long as 8 weeks. And my demeanor when I started presenting this information was just stop right there, or maybe I'd say, like the medical doctor, I'd say, "Oh, and I got to go. Be sure to pay the receptionist on the way out. I got to go play golf. See you next." Oh, or maybe I won't see you next time. So it was this incredibly heartless approach I was taking, and I was told by a few hosts and mostly hostesses that I wouldn't be doing that anymore. Thank you. And so now I sort of go back and forth between presenting the evidence indicative of our demise and describing how people might live with that evidence. And at this point, as I've been telling audiences on this tour, at this point, almost all of my presentation is a reaction to trolls on YouTube. And that's sort of a sad statement of our entire society. But it's largely true, because every time I've ever made a mistake, every time I've ever said something that was incorrect, I've been attacked vociferously, mostly on YouTube. And even when I say things that aren't inaccurate, the response is to twist my words until it appears I'm saying things that I'm not saying. And so now my presentation has turned into this, somebody once said this in response to me saying that, and so my response is so-and-so. And it's kind of maddening, and I feel like at the end that I could spend, instead of 50 minutes on a presentation, I could spend 50 minutes on each of my 35 slides. But that, I mean, that's where we are. This has been a long and relatively painful path for me to take. And largely in response to the inability of people to come to grips with their own death, much less the loss of an entire species that we consider so important, the one called Homo sapiens.
Like, how do you continue with your important work, and how do you manage to focus in a productive way when you constantly more and more have to defend yourself? Like, how does that play out?
You know, that's the other balance. There's these two balances going on in every presentation. The balance between presenting the evidence and indicating advice about what to do about it, which are things like living more fully today and pointing out that we were never guaranteed another day and so on. And then there's the other tough issue, the other balancing act of trying to stick to the evidence without being reactionary, trying to defend myself sometimes in advance without really even defending myself. I mean, I'm just presenting the evidence generated by other people. I'm just collating it and using it to point out where we're going and how quickly. And it's tough to take on that information because we're in this culture that doesn't deal well with the really important issues like grief and grieving and death and dying and sex and bodily functions, and all that sort of thing, where our food comes from and what happens to it before we eat it. We don't talk about any of that really important stuff. You know, we talk about the weather. And my response to that one is a great meme I saw the other day. Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody's willing to sacrifice a virgin to make it better.
Wow. I know what I write about. I find, like, super, super heavy, and, like, it's obviously overwhelming and depressing, you know, very heavy, especially because I'm interested in so many different issues, right? Once you go down paths and you recognize that everything's connected, it's not enough to look at one issue. You need to be able to look at the entire system, right? And, you know, including, obviously, industrialized civilization. Like, you have to... It's also heavy, so I'm just wondering, like, what do you do? Like, what do you suggest to people when they come to you on your tour and they ask you, you know, just how to deal with that type of heaviness, that grief, that pain? Like, is there any particular thing that you like to do that makes you feel better? Like, do you garden outside? Are you out a lot? You know, what are your outlets?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's only been very recently that I have started telling people what I actually do. Up until this tour, I've been telling people what they can do and what other people in their position have done, things like quoting Edward Abbey, action is the antidote to despair. And I don't despair, but a lot of people do upon hearing my message. And so they might want to take action. And for me, that means from a Buddhist inspired perspective, I'm not a Buddhist, but I've been inspired by Buddhism. Interestingly, starting with my readings of Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, who were also influenced by Buddhism, although they weren't Buddhists either. And so I promote the idea of right action and not being attached to the outcome. And so I actually promote action contrary to what I hear essentially every day, which is that I encourage people to roll over and die and to give up. Nothing could be further from the truth. I'm just not terribly attached to the outcome, considering that it's a whole bunch of doing that got us here. And maybe we should just stop doing. We now know that civilization is a heat engine. And every single answer or solution I hear about is rooted in the omnicidal heat engine to which we affectionately refer as civilization. So what is it that we're trying to do?
Yeah.
And so at the societal level, I think it's a little silly that we continue to try to do things. And at the individual level, I think the right actions are guided by compassion and empathy. They are guided by the emotional response we have when we work with people at a very intimate level. So, for example, the slide I've added just for this tour at the end of the presentation is filled with examples of the kinds of things I do currently. And one of them, just as one minor example, one of them is we're building a structure on the 57 acres where I live in Belize. And it would surprise me if I lived past October 1st of this year because of lethal wet bulb temperatures and the increasing likelihood of a collapse of American empire leading to very abrupt heating and thus triggering lethal wet bulb temperatures and in a place like Belize. So what we're doing, among other things, is the 10 people on the property are building a structure that will house other people. And people say, well, that's crazy. If you don't think you're going to live very long, why don't you just stop and be? And there's two answers to that. One, action is the antidote to despair, and so we're taking action. We think it's right action. We're building structures and employing people to house visitors and maybe even, quote, permanent residents, although the notion of permanence seems sort of ridiculous given what I just said about Buddhism. And perhaps more importantly, what we are doing is consistent with Aristotle's definition of friendship. Aristotle defined friendship as a relationship between people working together for the common good. And the two important elements there are working together and for the common good. And we view the common good as the 57 acres and beyond, the ability to house people who want to have the conversation nobody else is having. And the working together comes in the form of spending our days pounding nails and building these structures and sweating together and laughing together and eating together and creating community. So at the same time we are building structures, we are building community. And I think that's really, really important, and not just because it, quote, gives us something to do in the end times. I think we're doing something that is valuable and that helps our relationships.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. One thing I've learned, Guy, is how when you write about things, it doesn't even matter how intensely you can cite sources and back it up with science, with data. I mean, when you tell people, when you write about stuff that people don't want to hear, they often, more than often, react in a very angry manner. It makes people very angry. I'm not sure if that's part fear or what, but I mean, it's as old as time. I just wondered, do you ever get people coming to see you while you're on tour, you know, that just try to fight with you or just come just, you know, thinking they're going to set you straight? Or, you know, Basically to have a confrontation.
Yes, absolutely. That's the whole point. I was in Chicago, home of David Archer. And David Archer is a modeler who models methane. He and Gavin Schmidt are the two trailing voices. They think they're leading voices, but they're actually trailing voices when it comes to pointing out information about atmospheric methane.
Yeah, and I'm both well of them, aware of Archer.
Yeah, both of them use models and deny the evidence. They don't. They think the data should fit the models, not the other way around. And so they produce this utter nonsense, including that methane will never be an important greenhouse gas. Well, it's currently nearly 2,000 parts per billion in the atmosphere. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, it was 750 parts per billion in the atmosphere. So it's more than doubled, considerably more than doubled in the atmosphere. It's 100 times more powerful a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is, molecule for molecule. So it's kind of a big deal. So I had a David Archer acolyte show up. And
really?
Yeah. And she sat there patiently through the whole thing. And then she said, on one of your slides, you say the global dimming effect will be blah, blah, blah. And it's nowhere near that. It's no more than 0.3 degrees, according to the literature. Well, On my slide, I had references to two Referee Journal articles, one from December 2011 by James Hansen and colleagues, and another more recent paper, the latter of which indicates up to about a 3C global average temperature rise. I have no idea where she got the 0.3 degrees from global dimming. I think she just made it up, and she was just throwing it out there as if it was supported by evidence. And then she did another thing, not about methane, surprisingly, but about some other attribute that, again, I had scientific references from the very concern. And let's keep in mind, this is a very conservative process that generates the Referee Journal literature. So I think that everything I present is quite conservative. And she told me, based on no evidence, that she didn't agree. And I don't know where to go from there. You know, here's the evidence. Do you have counter evidence? I hope you do. But she didn't. And the deniers never do have actual evidence. They just have rumors, gossip, and innuendo from the likes of Michael Mann and David Archer and Gavin Schmidt.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been blown away, actually, at the lack of interest and the lack of attention, you know, on the whole methane thing. It just blows my mind how that is completely made to be irrelevant, you know, by academia and scientists and media, obviously, and it's such a huge issue. I mean, what is new on that front? Anyway, is there anything new out by Natalia Shakova?
Yes, she has a new paper out just within the last few months indicating things are accelerating just as she indicated they were and would be years ago when she basically disappeared. So there's all kinds of evidence. You can even turn to the mainstream media and find these methane pockets and pingos and bubbles of methane pouring up all over the world. And so it takes a pretty diligent effort to continue to deny what's going on out there in the world. But people keep going for that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Like, I don't know, did you see that video? I think it was out of Siberia, that rolling tsunami on the highway.
I did not see that.
Yeah, it's actually real footage, and it's like basically an underground tsunami on a highway, like basically just turning the highway over like it's nothing, and all the trees and everything from melting permafrost.
Well, what could possibly be wrong there? And, you know, the approach, the very conservative approach and the lack of urgency indicated by the people we've already mentioned suggests that everything is fine, and it abandons the precautionary principle. It abandons a sense of urgency. And people like Michael Mann, who continue to promote the mythical 2C target, are telling us that it's all going to be okay, just keep spending, keep getting out there and becoming part of the system that's destroying all life on Earth.
Yeah, and I mean the whole promotion, I mean basically all the NGOs are all united and the big message is clean energy. I mean, if it wasn't for the illusion that clean, you know, quote unquote clean energy will save us, I mean, maybe we'd actually have to deal with the problem. I mean, I think it's such a distraction. It's the ultimate distraction. And it's a joke, really, because last week I went up north, really, really far up north, where it was so beautiful. But anyway, I had to venture through Toronto, the highway 401, 400. Anyway, on the way back, I hit this highway that used to be a highway, but now all it is like a huge road that just connects. It's just, you know, I don't even know how to explain this. It's just one, there's a light put in on highway, imagine, about every 50 meters. And on both sides, it's just sprawl. I mean, sprawl like you've never even seen before. Luxury homes, every kind of fast food you can think of, every kind of shopping complex you can think of, gas stations. I mean, we can talk about all these, you know, fantasies of quote-unquote clean energy all we want. But in reality, that's what's happening. That's what's happening today. You know, wherever you go, it's not just in my city or in Toronto. This is what's happening all over the entire globe, you know, and this is what capitalism is, you know. This is what the system is, you know, perpetual growth at all costs. And, you know, in this case, the cost of life. Anyway, I think I'm going to start wrapping up now, Guy. And
I do. I want to mention just one quick thing, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I have a new weekly video production. It premiered 2 weeks ago, The Guy Fox and Jamie. So you can find it every recent blog post at Nature Bats Last. So with that, Corey, please take us home.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry that we weren't able to share an enlightening conversation with activist Michael Swift from Australia today, but we will have him back once we get our technical issues worked out. Be sure to catch Guy on tour in the Midwest. You can find him in and near Milwaukee, Chicago, Madison, Ames, Iowa, Kansas City, and St. Louis, Missouri, Indianapolis, and Lansing. And yeah, and those states and cities and everything, I'm Canadian. I don't know who belongs to who, but everyone in U.S. can figure that out. This all happens the 12th through the 24th of this month, July 2017. Details are available beneath the Coming Events tab at guymcpherson.com. Thanks, too, to was it Benji? Benji, who called in today. Thank you. We'll see you on the radio the first Tuesday afternoon of each month at 3 p.m. Eastern. That means our next show will broadcast live on Tuesday afternoon, the 1st of August. If you miss us live, make sure to find us in the archives at prn.fm or at Stitcher and rate us on iTunes. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PR.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the next show, and please share widely the link and information from this show. Also, continue to follow the Nature Bats Last blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. Thanks again to our listeners and Afrozen for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last. It's an echo.
Gonna get you.